Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
Hello, and welcome to this week's coronavirus live stream with Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanice, and I'm a health reporter for the site, and I'm here to answer your questions about COVID-19, drugs in development, the ongoing pandemic, etc., etc. If you have any questions throughout the live stream, please stick them in the comments below and we try to hit as many as possible. We do this for about half an hour to 40 minutes. And I begin these live streams typically with a short recap of news from the week. So just to give you a quick table of contents for what I'll be discussing. Given the extent of protests throughout the country, we talked with experts who shared safety tips about how to lower your risk of transmitting or catching COVID-19 if you are attending protests. In fact, most of these tips are relevant to anyone attending any sort of gathering and go for anyone coming into a crowded space, specifically an outdoor space. So I'll be discussing those tips for you. Jane Goodall gave an address earlier in the week and she spoke about how the world can move towards being more ready to handle future pandemics in terms of how we handle the sale and trade of wildlife, in terms of how we handle our use of environmental resources, because those are also connected to the movement of wildlife, as well as factory farming and how that practice has contributed to outbreaks of viruses in the past and could in the future if we don't make changes. So notes from Jane Goodall on that. I'll be briefly touching on safety guidelines for any offices that are reopening now and into the next couple of months, given that we do not have an approved treatment or vaccine as of yet. So what an office might look like, not post-COVID, but moving out of this first wave of the pandemic. And I'll be closing the recap on a new study that's come out. There's actually a second study that just came out yesterday corroborating this result. But looking at hydroxychloroquine as a preventative treatment for COVID-19. So if you take the drug, does it help lower your risk of catching the virus in the first place? And just to give you the long and short of that right now, it does not seem to offer any sort of significant benefit. And this was in a large sample size of patients, over 820 people were included in this trial I'll be mentioning. So hydroxychloroquine as a preventative doesn't appear to garner any benefit. To give you a quick update on the case counts, both worldwide and here in the US, total cases worldwide are now above 6.5 million confirmed. It should be noted that, number one, this is likely an undercount just due to the paucity of testing available worldwide. So not everyone who has COVID-19 will be tested and confirmed to have the virus. In addition, different countries sometimes count a positive case differently from each other. So for instance, in China, I've learned that they generally don't count asymptomatic cases as a confirmed case, but rather follow those. And if they become asymptomatic, that becomes a confirmed case. So that changes the numbers a bit. Although, regardless, the rate of transmission in China is far, 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 far down from the start of the pandemic. Their numbers have not risen very much at all. To touch on the U.S. case count, we have now exceeded 1.8 million cases nationwide, and the number of deaths in the U.S. has now exceeded 107,000. So worldwide deaths are up to 356,000. So you can see that the U.S. represents a large portion of those deaths worldwide. Moving into quick updates from the week. So just to start on trying to reduce your chances of transmitting COVID at a protest or catching COVID at a protest. Note that some of these tips are best suited for a very idealized situation, so they're not realistic for every single protest you attend, but rather, if you could follow all of these measures, it would greatly lower the risk of transmission for everybody. And it applies to everyone gathering in that space. So whether you are a protester or a police officer, these guidelines would help slow the spread of COVID-19. Just to lay out the inherent risk, naturally the virus uses humans to get around and transmit and continue to spread. So the more humans gather in one place, the more likely there will be some transmission, which is why the lockdowns discourage large groups gathering, even small groups gathering. So there's an inherent risk in that. The act of shouting especially produces, we know, higher levels of aerosols than does normal speech at a lower volume. So aerosols are small mist-like particles that can carry the virus and can hang in the air for some amount of time. Now, the fact that most of the protests are taking place outdoors in open air does help to disperse any aerosols, respiratory droplets as well. So the exact level of risk is a little unclear in outdoor spaces, but it's much riskier to be shouting in a confined, poorly ventilated indoor space. So there is some risk and mitigation with them being outside. Complicating factors, naturally, if tear gas is used in the area, tear gas incites coughing, causes the eyes and nose to run. So that if people are wiping their eyes and nose at all, if those deposits contain viral particles and then they touch something else, etc., that's a possible route of transmission. Coughing, as we know, disperses both aerosols and respiratory droplets. So that can be a primary route of transmission, as far as we know. In addition, things like tear gas can potentially irritate the upper and lower airways. And in the same way that during wildfire season in California, people's airways can become irritated and they then end up contracting slightly worse cases of influenza. For example, the same kind of effect might be seen with tear gassing because it does irritate the airways that then the virus is infecting. So if you were to catch COVID while dealing with coughing from tear gas, et cetera, your infection could be worsened by that, is what experts have told us. In addition, of course, anyone being crowded into paddy wagons or into jail cells, et cetera, we've already seen demonstrated that being in those confined, crowded spaces, including correctional facilities, exacerbates spread of the virus. We've seen outbreaks worldwide in prisons, and that's been a real issue. So this would be replicating that same problem. Given all those risks, how can you minimize your chances of spreading COVID and your chances of catching it if you are in these crowded spaces? First and foremost, if you are showing any symptoms of COVID or potential symptoms of other illnesses, anything, do not go to the gathering. People appear to be most symptomatic early in the course of illness, so a few days after those symptoms appear. So even if you're in the early course of illness, you stand as a potential threat to all those around you if you go with symptoms especially. Now, for those who are not showing symptoms, who do go to a protest, it's important to wear a face mask. More and more data is coming out now, looking back historically at the use of face masks, both for this pandemic, but also for the SARS and MERS epidemics. So there was a review study that came out that does suggest that even cloth face masks help significantly to reduce spread of the virus, especially when combined with social distancing of at least 3 feet, 6 feet if possible, farther if possible. So practicing social distancing, wearing your face mask, using hand sanitizer frequently, eye protection such as goggles or a face shield, also helpful in terms of the virus being deposited on your eyes and also you touching your eyes and potentially depositing virus in that way. If you are going to a protest, try to stick to a core group of people. So bring buddies with you, not only just safety in numbers, obviously, but from a virus standpoint, from a disease transmission standpoint, if you're in a bubble of people whom you already have close contact with, that's limiting your potential interactions with others to a certain degree. So if you stick to that core group, you can kind of see that perhaps the crowd surrounding you would give you a slightly wider berth because you are in a cluster, so-called, and your potential contacts with others in the crowd might be lessened in that way. If you are concerned about spread through shouting, bringing noisemakers of some sort instead as an alternative to shouting was suggested by one expert we talked to, but if you are wearing a mask, that should mitigate the risk of shouting somewhat. Again, the risk is not zero. You want that face mask to be pretty tight to your face. If you do have one with a filter in it of some sort, those seem to work well at filtering the air a bit more in terms of incoming air especially. But aerosols, as people have discussed with me now, aerosols basically take the path of least resistance out of the mask. So you can imagine if you have large gaps in your mask, there's going to be a lot more aerosols released towards people. So as tight as that mask can be is more helpful. Following the protest, when you do get home, it's advised that you wash your hands and wash those clothes that you were wearing at the protest. Continue to take basic health precautions, staying hydrated, eating the right foods, sleeping as much as possible, etc. Monitor yourself for symptoms, especially in terms of perhaps developing a fever. Early symptoms for some people might just be digestive issues. You might note a loss of smell and taste. There's kind of early warning signals. But again, the disease manifests in many different ways in different people. We do have a breakdown of the symptoms that have been noted thus far on the website if you want to check those out. But monitor yourself for symptoms of COVID. And if you do develop any symptoms, go get tested immediately. If you haven't developed symptoms, one expert suggested that you get tested about 4 days after attending an event, and then potentially 4 days after that if you want to do due diligence. So just checking yourself to see if you do have the infection. Another expert recommended 5 days after the event. The exact time course there is a little up in the air. But just monitoring yourself for symptoms and consider getting tested a few days following the event. You don't want to necessarily go immediately because if you are infected, it will take a little bit for that viral load, the amount of virus in you, to build. So it might not be detectable immediately after infection. So waiting 4 to 5 to 6 days might be the best course of action. In general, especially if you're interacting with people who did not attend the protest and are potentially at high risk of a severe COVID infection, it's recommended that you quarantine yourself for at least 2 weeks following a protest. So if you're going to gathering after gathering after gathering, that clock resets. It doesn't count from that first protest you attended. Just consider who you're interacting with, whether you should be distancing yourself from vulnerable folks in your life is one of the main things. Especially in terms of if you're in a low-risk category, you certainly wouldn't want to bring that virus, bring that illness to someone else. Just going to touch quickly on some notes Jane Goodall gave earlier this week. So she was making an address with also European Union commissioners, and she spoke to the effect of habitat loss and specifically deforestation, potential disease transmission between animals and humans. So in this case, in all likelihood, all data points to this virus having come from a bat originally, just as SARS and MERS did. And habitat loss, again, specifically deforestation, drives animals to seek out new shelter, and they often move into nearby human settlements, whether they take refuge in the trees, etc. And this increases the likelihood of contact between humans and those animals who serve as reservoirs of disease. So considering that effect, moving forward in terms of land use and resource use, it's important to consider also the threat of infectious disease transmission in planning how we better use resources in the natural environment. In addition, the trade of wild animals for food, fur, or traditional medicine, particularly at wet markets, where wild animals can sometimes be sold alongside domesticated animals and produce. Not every wet market has wild animal trade necessarily, just for context. But the active trade of wild animals in this way, again, increases risk of transmission. And more broadly, bushmeat trade, so the trade of meat outside of marketplaces, or within them, of meat from wild animals is also a concern in terms of disease transmission. And historically, we've seen issues of diseases housed in animals spilling over to humans in this way. And the same might go for this virus in terms of where the mingling of species first began. We don't know exactly where this virus made the jump from bats potentially to a middle animal and then humans. And just to round that out, factory farming also introduces real threats of diseases getting from animals to humans. We saw this with bird and swine flu in terms of handling of pigs and poultry as an example. But if animals are housed very close together and are dealing with poor hygienic conditions and are catching a variety of pathogens and, again, mingling disease among different types of animals, especially all that sort of thing. Meanwhile, also, there's a heavy use of antibiotics in factory farming, and that leads to the development of drug-resistant superbugs, just as we see in humans. So we see the overuse of antibiotics in humans also lead to that development. Same goes for animals. So all these things set factory farms up to be another potential source of animal-borne disease crossing over to humans. So considering all these issues, we're talking about major reforms that need to take place if we don't want another pandemic like this one or worse than this one to emerge in coming years. And these are enormous issues that take reform at a very high level. Touching briefly on what offices might look like as they're opening during this time, the CDC is now recommending that if you are opening offices, you conduct daily temperature screenings of employees coming in and symptom checks. So people cataloging what symptoms of COVID they might be developing before they enter the office, requiring employees to wear face coverings in all workspaces, moving workstations farther apart to maintain social distancing measures. If possible, they're recommending that people commute alone, so rather than carpool, to limit their contacts with others. We're based in New York. So again, these recommendations are better for some places than others. Improving ventilation in workspaces can cut down on the amount of virus that hangs stuck in the air and can, in the same way that outdoor spaces lower risk of transmission, better ventilation in indoor spaces can also lower risk fairly significantly. Of course, advocating for frequent office cleanings and providing disinfectants for employees to use on a daily basis, to whether you're wiping down your desk, using a shared space, anything like that. So all basically very common sense kind of guidelines offered by the CDC, but taken en masse, it is a lot of measures to put in place to really keep employees and everyone safe if you are reopening offices at this time. Finally, wrapping up the update, just to touch on a study of over 820 people that has concluded that hydroxychloroquine does not appear to offer any benefit as a preventative treatment for COVID-19. So these people in a double-blind study, meaning neither the doctors giving them the drugs nor the patients knew which drug they were receiving. So they either got hydroxychloroquine or they received a placebo drug. And the blinding effect is to reduce biases in data collection so that you're not subconsciously biased about what improvements you might be seeing in these patients when you're taking the data. So in a double-blind study, after 2 weeks, all of these individuals had been exposed to COVID-19 either through their work as a healthcare worker or because someone in their household tested positive for the disease. So for 2 weeks after receiving treatment and after having been exposed, there was not a significant difference at all between those who received treatment and those who received a placebo in terms of developing symptoms of COVID-19 and developing a positive case. So one thing that the treatment group did have at higher rates than the placebo is they had the emergence of side effects such as nausea, upset stomach, and diarrhea, so mostly digestive, from taking hydroxychloroquine. The placebo group did not show a high rate of these sort of symptoms from taking the placebo. We're getting a lot of other data coming out about hydroxychloroquine as a drug to treat COVID-19. Most of them seem to be pointing to it having risks of serious side effects, including heart arrhythmias, which we knew about before. given its use for other illnesses already. But those studies are ongoing. The WHO paused their international study briefly, but now it's back online. So we'll still be receiving more information about it as a treatment for COVID-19 itself. Coming to your questions, I'm getting the question, if you don't catch COVID-19, you won't have antibodies to the disease. Yes. When a new pathogen enters your body, if it's a very low dose of the virus or bacterium or whatever have you, the body will sometimes mount just a more generalized immune response that deals with that virus and clearing it out of your body. So we see that occur when you catch COVID-19. But if it's a high enough dose, and we're seeing this at very low doses of the virus for context, your body mounts a more specific response to that new pathogen that it's encountering. Part of this response are neutralizing antibodies. The neutralizing antibodies are structures that latch on to specific parts of a virus, and they tag it for destruction, in essence, and help the immune system to clear that from the body. So that's a specific attack against a specific pathogen or contaminant, etc. So if you have not been exposed to COVID-19, you likely do not have any antibodies that would overlap with antibodies that latch on to that virus. Small caveat being that there are other coronaviruses circulating. So there is some slight chance of cross immunity, for instance, with less likely with the common cold coronaviruses, of which there are four. Those circulate through the population every year. But with people who have previously been infected with SARS or MERS in the early 2000s, it is possible that antibodies they develop against those viruses might have some cross effect on this new virus. It's unknown whether that cross immunity is robust in terms of how effective it is at fighting off the new virus. Those studies are underway, and blood drawn from people who caught SARS in the past, again in the early 2000s, has been reanalyzed by many groups recently, and they're looking for potential antibodies that offer cross immunity between the two to develop treatments based on those old antibodies that could be repurposed towards treating COVID-19 now. So good question. That's where the antibody test comes in as well. So if you receive an antibody test and you test negative, presuming the test gives you an accurate result, there is some margin of error there. But if you get an accurate negative result, that would mean that you likely have not been exposed to the virus, and your body, if there is potential immunity granted by being exposed, you do not have that yet, is what an antibody test might indicate. I'm getting a question about vaccines, how close we are to finding one. There are many vaccines in development now, and a good number, roughly a dozen or so, are in clinical trials in humans. There's some front runners that we hear more about, perhaps a handful, that have made it all the way to phase 2 trials. So vaccine development typically takes place in 4 phases. The first phase, after development of the vaccine itself, before phase 1 even begins, you have development of the drug and you have testing in cell cultures and also animal models. So that's all preclinical work before it gets to humans. And then phase 1 begins, and that's looking mostly at safety in humans. So whether different doses of the vaccine garner unacceptable side effects. So for instance, an acceptable side effect might be slight inflammation at the site of the injection. You might get transient flu-like symptoms where you develop a very mild fever for a day or so. You feel kind of out of it for a day or so. Things like that are acceptable in this context because they signal that the immune system is coming online. Now, if you feel very faint and you lose consciousness at any point, any dramatic side effects that might put one at severe risk, those are unacceptable. So that's what that initial phase 1 trial is all about, is seeing what dose seems to be safest for people initially and whether there's any side effects to deal with right away in case they need to go back to the drawing board a bit and fix the vaccine before going on. Phase 2 trials look more closely at efficacy, meaning how effective is the vaccine at generating an immune response in the body? How many antibodies are generated at different doses? What kind of antibodies are generated? So there's various types of antibodies. Some of them can latch onto a drug or onto a pathogen, but they aren't necessarily neutralizing. So you want those neutralizing antibodies. And there are various classes of those as well. So looking very specifically at what does the vaccine do in the body in terms of protecting it from future disease. Phase 3 does the same thing in a much larger group and more diverse group of patients. Moving on to see what the wide range of side effects might be in a population and also what the wide range of immune responses might be in a larger group of people. Once a vaccine passes at phase 3, it can be approved at that point. And it may be that in this more urgent scenario, phase 3 is cut short and a vaccine might be approved early. Fauci said this earlier on in the year. But following phase 3, the vaccine is produced for more widespread use. And this is what they know is called phase 4. So it's already being used in the population, but there's continued surveillance to follow up and see how people do over a longer period of time. And that's when we can really see in action how well a vaccine is doing at preventing the illness, given that a pathogen is circulating. There's a question as to whether a drug would take longer to make than a vaccine. And why is it that we want to make a vaccine and not just a drug that treats the illness once you have it? So given that everyone in the population is vulnerable to catching COVID-19, and there, of course, are people at high risk of a more severe infection that could lead you to become hospitalized and potentially die from the illness. So that's a certain proportion of people, but it seems that anyone can pick up the virus and garner some sort of infection. It's just the range of symptoms that varies. So given how many people can potentially be affected, treatments are a good step forward. But if we want to get a handle on the pandemic at a larger and more lasting scale, that requires vaccination. So treatments are delivered after you've caught the infection already. If people are coming into the hospital system and require care, require that medication, you can see how that puts strain on the healthcare system. That requires that people seek care and get that medication. Now, you can avoid all that if people are vaccinated with an effective vaccine. So it prevents future infections and lifts the burden off of all the people who then have to treat the people who do become infected. And of course, once a vaccine is developed, because so many people are vulnerable to the illness, deployment is going to take a long time in terms of distribution. So as we go, there'll be people who get the vaccine first, and perhaps they will be protected, but there'll be a large proportion of the population that is not protected until they get the vaccine. So the treatment is definitely important for everyone who remains vulnerable. And then as we vaccinate, the need for that medication lessens and lessens and lessens, if that all makes sense. Now, in terms of a drug taking longer than a vaccine, that's not necessarily the case. Vaccines typically take 5 to 10 to 15 years to develop. In this scenario, we're trying to get a vaccine out within the course of a year to 2 years, which is very fast compared to normal, typical vaccine development. Now, drugs, depending on, there are many trials that drugs go through before they reach people, so it varies how long they take. And antivirals are particularly tricky for a variety of reasons, but it's not necessarily the case that a drug would take longer than a vaccine to develop. There are many drugs in clinical trials now, both existing drugs that are being given off-label, meaning they were approved for one purpose and are being used for COVID-19 on an exploratory basis, and there's also new drugs being developed. So in the end, we'll just have to see what wins out. I'm getting a question about whether herd immunity is possible. Herd immunity is quote-unquote possible, but I think the question is at what cost? So herd immunity refers to when so many people in the population have caught a disease already that they now have immunity to catching it again. Number one, that makes a key assumption that immunity is long-lasting and even perhaps permanent. With other coronaviruses, with the seasonal ones, we see that people can catch them more than once. So we know with coronaviruses, there's likely a drop-off in immunity through time. So it's not necessarily that you're permanently immune to COVID-19 after you catch it one time. And we don't know the answer to that question yet. But previous data looking at SARS and MERS suggests that immunity might last, at least robust immunity, might only last 1 to 2 years following the first infection. We don't know how long immunity lasts for this virus. So in that case, even if magically, for instance, if I could snap my fingers and a large enough percentage of the population had caught it already to have immunity right now, that immunity might still be transient. And then we would have the same problem again in the future, if that makes sense. In addition, the proportion of people who need to catch a disease to reach herd immunity is incredibly high. And again, since everyone is vulnerable to this virus and we're not, there's certainly people in high-risk categories, but there's also historically healthy people who have developed serious blood clots and strokes and all sorts of symptoms to the disease that they might not have realized they were in a high-risk category to develop these symptoms. So all that said, you don't want 50 to 70% of a population to have to catch a disease to save us from the pandemic. That's not really saving us from the pandemic. That's more letting the pandemic happen. Particularly for people who, for instance, we know we've seen nursing homes, correctional facilities, other confined spaces with vulnerable folks who can't go anywhere else. We've seen these get hit particularly hard. So even if a virus is by chance or by luck not circulating or hitting the wider population very hard, once it gets into these high-risk facilities or locations, you see that effect hit very hard. So in reaching herd immunity, you are putting those folks at higher risk overall. Here's where vaccines come in. Vaccines get you to, they basically simulate herd immunity by introducing immunity to the virus without giving you the disease itself. So that's the benefit of vaccine, is once enough people are vaccinated, it protects the wider population from the infection. And this goes for all vaccines in terms of highly transmissible diseases. I'm going to wrap up with two more questions. Thank you for submitting. I'm getting a question about challenge studies. This person did not use the word challenge studies, but the idea behind a challenge study in a vaccine context is that you give people the vaccine, and to test whether the vaccine works, you give them the pathogen deliberately. And this has been something that's been considered and discussed within the medical community, but also just bioethicists are weighing in on this issue. And there are people, at least anecdotally, who have said they would be interested in participating in such a trial, given that they themselves are in a low-risk category. The thing about challenge studies is if they're successful, they can definitely expedite the production of a vaccine because you can see whether it's effective right away. You don't have to wait for someone to catch the virus. On that note, they're very expensive and hard to administer. So they do have limited utility in that way. You can't just set up a bunch of challenge studies very quickly. They require extensive consent forms, for instance, because this is a very dangerous prospect. Again, people don't know necessarily if they're in a high-risk group. There's potential genetic factors that we don't understand very well yet that could put someone at high risk of severe complications. So when you give someone the vaccine and then give them the virus, those people then have to be monitored by healthcare professionals ongoing to see how they're faring. And if they do develop symptoms, they then have to be treated with the hospital symptoms, of course, your system. And then, of course, you're also dealing with potential transmission if they do become infected. So it's a high risk scenario. You're putting, by volunteering for such a study, you could potentially be putting your life at risk. And this has to be acknowledged in how the study is set up and how it is conducted. So this is something that could potentially happen. We don't have one underway yet, but it's been heavily discussed, especially within the last couple months, and bioethicists have weighed in, and there are ways of conducting such studies, and similar studies have been conducted in the past. So it's not completely unprecedented. The other caveat to challenge studies is that those who volunteer will, of course, likely be in a very low-risk group. So they're not necessarily representative of those in high-risk groups, which is important given that this virus, again, affects a wide variety of people. For instance, you're not necessarily going to recruit older individuals, those above, say, the age of 65 for such a study, because it's very high risk. And we want to make sure this vaccine works in that population of people, because at the age of 65, we see both hospitalizations and the rate of mortality tick up fairly dramatically. And then once you are above the age of about 84 or so, it really gets quite high proportionally. So in developing such a vaccine, you're going to have a really limited sample size, which is also not best for vaccine studies that have to apply to a wide and diverse group of people. So that's another factor to consider about challenge studies. Wrapping up on one final question. Someone has given me an anecdote, so I'm reading through it now. Just generally speaking, to make this more of a general question, someone's asking if it's safe to plan trips or vacations to more perhaps remote locations, say you want to go camping or something and you're not going to be crowded around other people necessarily. Is this a safe thing to plan for perhaps in the fall sometime? This will remain a huge question. Right now, we're kind of in a limbo where we're both seeing, as of a week to 2 weeks ago, states largely throughout the country entered some phase of reopening. Some of these states that are reopening were still riding their first wave of infection. So there is, in movement at all, state to state, there's going to be some risk of transmission, and we don't know how the cases might uptick in the coming weeks. In addition, of course, you have the complication of people now gathering for protests and having that be widespread throughout the country. So I think in the following 2 to 3 weeks, we're really going to get a better feel for where the country is at now, where we are at baseline. So in that respect, planning a trip for a couple of months from now, you might want to hold off a little bit, is my feeling personally. Again, that's kind of a personal reflection. But again, it takes about 2 to 3 weeks for any surge in cases to hit the data, because the incubation period of the virus extends from a few days to about a week or so. If you are planning to go somewhere and be in a fairly remote location among only a few close contacts, that is a fairly low risk scenario. Just think about all the steps that you're taking to get to said place, how many people you have to interact with, whether any of you are at risk of having caught the virus. If it's a fairly high chance, that might not be the best time for that person to travel with you, depending on your demographic. And that's kind of all personal risk assessment you have to do. In the grand scheme of things, going to a more remote location away from people, generally speaking, would be a fairly safe bet. But if you do contract the virus, also think about what medical resources the area you're going to has. There was early on a retreat to kind of remote places from big cities, for instance, and some smaller towns or places with not a lower population of people might not have as robust a medical system as you have at home necessarily. So if you as an outsider are coming into vacation someplace, make sure to consider, if I get sick, what could happen then? Have a plan in place is a good precaution to take. And there's obviously many risk factors involved on a personal level in terms of your own health status. But certainly wait a couple weeks before making any plans. It's my personal feeling. And then certainly planning farther in advance is likely a safer bet. But again, everything is up in the air. We learn more things day to day. And on that note, I'm going to round off this week's live stream. Thank you again for tuning in. If you do have more questions, you can both join us again next week. But again, check out livescience.com and the forums at forums.livescience.com.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the live science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.